Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The consequences of recent upheaval in the Middle East went deep into the world's oil markets today. OPEC members failed to reach an agreement on output. Prices rose slightly on the news. And now the question remains whether worldwide demand will shift enough to make a difference. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's Magazine, providing market ideas and insights to help readers manage their investments and protect their financial well-being, online at barrons.com. And by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the internet. Reputation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, the 8th day of June. The price of crude jumped by more than $2 a barrel today. A key meeting of the oil producers' cartel, OPEC, failed to find agreement on an increase in production. The meeting in Vienna was a contentious one, and that is putting it mildly. Now, just weeks after a consumer pullback that prompted gas prices to drop, there are fears of another sharp rise in the price of oil, which would not bode well for any kind of global economic recovery. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
By all accounts, today's OPEC meeting was poisonous. Libya is furious at Qatar because it's backed the rebellion against Colonel Gaddafi. But there's an even more fundamental divide in the cartel between those countries like Saudi Arabia with big reserves that want a stable price for their oil and those like Iran, Libya and Venezuela who have little spare capacity. Samuel Chizuk is an oil analyst with IHS Global Insight.
Those who are sort of starting to see the end of their reserves are obviously interested in sort of maximizing the amount of money they will get out of it.
That group of countries today refused to back Saudi Arabia's call to pump more oil and restrain prices, hence the jump in the price of crude. But the Saudis hinted they may step up production anyway. Chris Skrabowski of Peak Oil Consulting says this could herald the end of OPEC.
I think it's probably a 60 or 70% chance that this will fundamentally change the cartel, that in practical terms it will split.
With Saudi Arabia pumping more oil and with OPEC in disarray, that would seem to be good news for beleaguered oil consumers. But as Professor Kent Moores of Duquesne University told the Marketplace Morning Report, don't bet on it.
Well, gas prices probably have gone down as much as they're going down nationally. We're not going back anywhere close to $3.30 or thereabouts.
Such is the rapid growth in demand for oil in China, India and elsewhere, the price seems headed inexorably higher. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It's been more than a year since the big healthcare reform law passed, and we are still asking, what will it mean, especially for those who have insurance through their employers? Well, a new report out from McKinsey & Company found it may mean a whole lot of us won't be offered insurance at our jobs anymore. 30% of employers said they probably would stop offering workers health insurance after 2014. That's when the bulk of the law takes effect, including the option of state-run insurance exchanges. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
If it were just a question of the bottom line, Mark Kallenbeck would drop coverage for his workers in a heartbeat. He runs a housing management company in Portland, Oregon. He's got about 350 employees. In the year 2014, he figures he could send those workers to buy their own coverage through Oregon's new insurance exchange. He'd pay a $2,000 penalty per worker and still have lots of cash left over.
Would we do it if it wasn't in our employees' interests and only in our own? That would be a very, very tough decision.
Because Kallenbeck has grown up in a world where employers have to offer health plans to attract the best workers. Bob Atlas of Avalier Health says that calculus could shift.
Employers of low-wage workers who already don't offer generous benefits might start to move first.
This could create a cascade effect, with more businesses offering to raise wages while sending employees to the exchanges for coverage.
In fact, some folks say the exchanges will offer more choice than what an employer can offer. Premiums might actually go down.
The research firm McKinsey found that 30% of employers may drop coverage after 2014. Other analysts say that employer coverage will stay flat or increase. Steve King of Emergent Research says that employer behavior is so hard to predict, in part because nobody knows if the exchanges will work.
Most employers are not going to want to send their employees into lousy health care coverage.
Which brings us back to Kallenbeck, the Oregon business owner we heard from up top. He'd be happy to stop paying the cost of health care, just so long as his employees don't stop wanting to work for him. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Firefighters haven't been able to make much progress on that 600-square-mile forest fire in Arizona. Thousands of people have been evacuated from their homes, and flames are now headed toward transmission lines that carry electricity as far away as Texas. But fires are also burning in Texas, Alaska, New Mexico, and Georgia. Flooding continues to threaten areas across the Midwest. Tornado sites around the country still need cleaning up. Last year, the U.S. logged a record number of federal disasters, and this year stands to break that record. In the thick of all these crises, states have no money to cover the expense. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
When big fires hit, states rally. So Oregon pilots are dropping red, fire-killing chemicals over Arizona blazes. Rod Nichols at the Oregon Department of Forestry says that helps his agency's budget.
Our people are off our payroll for a while and on the payroll of whichever state they're working for.
Oregon won't send the bill to Arizona until everyone's home.
Administrative people often talk about the real fire season occurring after, meaning all of the accounting.
Arizona's bill could be mostly picked up by the feds if President Obama declares a national disaster. But he'll only do that if lots of homes and businesses burned. Arizona won't know how many until flames die down. Eric Holdeman consults communities on emergency management.
That's why there's this intense pressure on getting a presidential declaration, because without it, then there's nothing for the individual citizens because they don't have a disaster program whatsoever.
He says many states raided disaster funds to fill budget gaps, so governors depend on federal aid. But it's subjective. The White House didn't label Texas fires a national disaster. The burn area is mostly sagebrush. Now the Texas governor has to find money for cleanup.
He has no additional relief, and that's just putting him further in the hole. They're going to have to cut other programs.
Holdeman says smaller-scale disasters can be the biggest problem for states. If, say, a tornado destroys a few homes, residents have only broke local agencies and charity to turn to. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, day number six of the sad music as investors puzzle over what is happening in the broader economy. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Once upon a time, manufacturing was the driving force behind the U.S. economy. It turned factory workers into middle-class consumers. President Obama is hoping that reviving that part of the economy could be an answer to the unemployment crisis. Today, he made a stop at Northern Virginia Community College to announce an expanded federal job training program for the manufacturing sector.
But the goal isn't just making sure that somebody's got a certificate or a diploma. The goal is to make sure your degree helps you to get a promotion or a raise or a job.
Manufacturing jobs are just one side of the equation. The other, community college students. Our education correspondent Amy Scott is with us from WYPR in Baltimore to talk more about the president's plan. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Tess.
So how's this program going to work?
Well, one of the complaints about job training programs is that students often spend a lot of time and money and then have trouble finding a job, you know, because the skills that they learn don't really match up with what employers are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So the White House is working with community colleges and manufacturers to create a standardized system so that if you go to school and you earn a credential, that credential will be recognized by a range of employers and across state lines. And the goal is to help some 500,000 community college students get jobs in manufacturing.
Why community colleges?
Well, they already do a lot of the vocational training in this country. They tend to have good relationships with local employers. They're low cost and, you know, you can get a credential pretty quickly. But I spoke with Thomas Bailey with the Community College Research Center at Teachers College. And he says this is also a part of President Obama's larger goals to try to get more U.S. workers some kind of education after high school.
And if you think about how you're going to do that at a reasonable cost, community colleges are an obvious site to try to do that.
But you know, Tess, other colleges do vocational training, like for-profit schools, and they're naturally not very happy about all this attention community colleges are getting, especially at a time when the Obama administration is tightening regulations for for-profit schools.
Right, right. And we saw that actually up on Capitol Hill this week. The other point of this is to try to jumpstart the manufacturing sector, right? But, you know, there's been such a long decline in manufacturing over the years. Will there really be enough jobs for all these people?
Well, believe it or not, manufacturing has actually been leading the economic recovery. In the last year and a half, the sector has added close to 250,000 jobs. That is, of course, just a fraction of the jobs lost in the recession. But the White House points out also that more than 2 million older manufacturing workers are likely to retire in the next 10 years. So we'll need trained workers to replace them. And as you said, the hope is that, you know, a better workforce will help U.S. manufacturers be more competitive and, in the end, create more jobs.
All right. Marketplace's Amy Scott joining us from Baltimore. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel was the guest of honor at a state dinner last night. On the menu, tuna tartare, petit filet, and of course, Apfelstrudel. But overseas, there is a sour taste in Europe, namely over Germany's decision to eliminate nuclear power from its energy policy. The president of the Czech Republic called the choice, quote, absurd. Commentator David Frum says the U.S. needs to discuss the matter with Chancellor Merkel.
Here's one question President Obama should ask her. What are you doing to the most important economy in Europe? German Chancellor Angela Merkel has announced a plan to permanently close all of Germany's 17 remaining nuclear reactors by 2022. This follows a temporary moratorium on nuclear power imposed in March. Granted, there is a large measure of grandstanding in this decision. Germany long ago outsourced much of its electricity production to nuclear-reliant France and the coal-burning Czech Republic. Since the March moratorium, electricity imports from France and the Czech Republic have doubled. Granted, also, there's a certain amount of cynicism here at work. When the German government ordered the closing of Germany's aging nuclear plants, it also assumed responsibility for some of the costs. That gift to the German electricity industry sent Germany's equivalent of the S&P 500 surging to its highest level in weeks on the day after Merkel's announcement. Those caveats noted, however, the question remains. What are the Germans doing? If it wishes to continue to reduce its burning of coal, Germany has two main alternatives to nuclear-generated power, wind and gas. Wind power is expensive, and German wind power is more expensive than most because Germany's wind farms are located offshore in the North Sea. By committing to wind, Germany commits itself to permanently higher costs. More likely, then, Germany will use wind as an eco-decoration and eco-distraction for its real energy strategy, gas-fired electricity. Gas-fired power is cost-effective, but German gas is imported from Russia, and more imports will only intensify Germany's already troubling strategic dependency on an authoritarian regime. In a sluggish world economy, the United States needs Germany to thrive and expand. So the question, what are they doing to the most important economy in Europe?
David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. He is now editor of Frum Forum. Robert Reich is up in the rotation next week. Meantime, send us your comments. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact. Coming up, Chinese students work hard to get into college and then burn out.
In fact, maybe they're taking some very creative people and making them uncreative. And so this has tremendous economic implications.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 21 points, 0.1% to finish at 12,048. The NASDAQ took off 26 points, almost 1%, to end the day at 2675. The S&P 500 ticked down 5 points, that's 0.4%, to close at 1279. The Dow and the S&P are on a run of 6 straight losing sessions, as we mentioned earlier. Visa deducted nearly 4%. MasterCard gave back 1.5% after the Senate voted to allow the Federal Reserve to reduce credit card swipe fees. American Express lost 1.6%. Exxon pumped up 1% on news of major deep water discovery in the Gulf of Mexico, up to 700 million barrels worth of oil. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.94%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, working with customers around the world to connect ideas to opportunities across food, agriculture, finance, and industry. Information at Cargill.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, which monitors mileage and safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. Learn more at Progressive.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Comer Science and Education Foundation, dedicated to supporting innovative programs making a positive impact on the lives of individuals and communities. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on international trade for April. The American Association of University Professors continues its annual conference on the state of higher education. And let's turn our attention to space, the final frontier. NASA talks about conditions at the edge of our solar system. A new computer model shows that it's filled with a turbulent sea of magnetic bubbles. Picture that. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, in for Kai Rizdahl. Oh, my Lord, Los Angeles is being invaded by mythical knights, avenging mutants, zombie hordes, and World War II tank divisions. Standard fare for Tinseltown, of course, but the invaders this week are not the product of Hollywood's celluloid dreams. They are the digital creations of the gaming industry. E3 is in town, the annual conference of gamers, and our own Steve Henn got the great assignment to be there. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you. So how's the gaming business?
Well, you know, it's in a state of flux. Sales and revenue for the big gaming consoles like Nintendo and Xbox actually fell last year, something like 13%. You know, it's still a $10 billion industry, but that was a big drop.
It is indeed. What's going on?
Well, you know, some of the smartest people in the industry say the price of what people are willing to pay for an hour of entertainment for a video game is dropping like a rock. Bing Gordon was the creative director for EA, Electronic Arts, for years, and he's now a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley and on the board of Zynga, the company behind Farmville. And in the early 80s, Gordon actually helped set the prices for video games. And he says back then, people were willing to pay like a dollar an hour for entertainment. Today, that's fallen to something like 15 cents or a nickel.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, and if you think about it, like your iPhone games, like Angry Birds, are 99 cents. And there are games on Facebook, like Farmville, that are free.
Well, then how are the Sonys and Nintendos of the world dealing with that?
They're cutting their prices. Sony just unveiled its new handheld gaming system here. It's called the Sony Vita. And really, this thing has all the hardware of a top-of-the-line smartphone. It has wireless, some have 3G connections, multiple cameras, touch screens, super fast state-of-the-art chips. And they're selling it for $250. You know, they're just not going to get a lot of profit out of that at that price. The other thing that's going on is the big game publishers like Electronic Arts and Capcom, the folks that create most of the hits for these game systems, are putting out more and more elaborate games, trying to justify their sticker prices of $60, $70, $80. John Davidson is a vice president at GameSpot, and he's been following the industry for years.
Now you routinely hear about $20 million games, $40 million games. If the rumors are true, the Star Wars game is like $100 million that they just spent to make the Old Republic. So to place a bet is just like, you know, I think to a lot of people, that's insanity, right?
So Davidson says either these old line gaming companies are going to have to come up with new ways to get people to pay for their gaming fix, or they could be headed for some serious trouble.
I think over the next 3 to 5 years, it's going to be anarchy here particularly, because the mobile space is shaking things up, the free-to-play space is shaking things up.
You know, and the business model of the big gaming companies is under attack. You know, the mutant hordes are being driven to the verge of extinction by sweet little iPhone apps like Angry Birds and invasions of virtual piglets on Farmville.
Well, I challenge anyone to come up with a bigger waste of time, at least for me, than Angry Birds.
Yeah.
Marketplace's Steve Henn joining us from the E3 conference just down the street here in Los Angeles. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing. Take care.
Another Wednesday is upon us, and so time to check the inbox.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Last week, we looked at the conflicts that arise between renewable energy activists and conservationists. What happens when a new wind farm might harm fragile ecosystems? Janine Blaylock directs the Western Lands Project, a Seattle-based nonprofit, and she says the green versus green debate is a false one.
The true irony is that the Environmental Protection Agency has identified millions of acres of degraded or contaminated lands suitable for renewable energy development. And there's also a vast potential for distributed solar generation in the built environment. Parking lots, commercial and residential rooftops, and everywhere one can imagine.
Our story this week about Steve Jobs' unveiling of Apple's new iCloud, which lets you store music and other data online and sync among your devices, drew a response from Ryan Verberkmos of Portland, Oregon. He didn't think we made a big enough deal of it.
Today's announcements could change the next 10 years of computing in the same fundamental way the iPod changed everything during the past decade when it was introduced 10 years ago. It's a huge deal, and suggesting Apple might be off its game because of Jobs' illness shows you missed the entire story.
And our segment on how marketers track shoppers' eye movements to see what draws their attention got the attention of Peggy Kokoris of Wheelwright, Massachusetts. She says she often has other things on her mind while browsing grocery aisles.
I'll stare unseeing at a product or hold one in my hand while I'm making computations in my head or thinking about whether I really would use or eat this product. I might even be trying to remember whether I fed the cat before I left home. Studies like this aren't just creepy. They can be downright wrong.
If you've been wandering the supermarket aisles thinking of a story you heard on Marketplace, please do write to us. Send your letters to marketplace.org. Just click on the link that says contact, and please don't forget to feed the cat. We've been reporting this week on the Gaokao, the National College Entrance Exam being taken by high school students across China. The test will determine whether they get into college, what they'll study, and pretty much shape the rest of their lives. But those who do get into school have a tendency to stop doing something they've done for 13 straight years. Study. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz has the second of three reports.
It's 10 in the morning. College student Xie Zhihui should be in class, but he hasn't been to class all semester. He's been too busy pretending to be a basketball star. Xie stares into his laptop, hair in his face, playing an NBA video game. His roommates squeeze by him, heading to the campus courts to play the real thing. They're skipping class, too. The six live in this musty room the size of a walk-in closet at Hebei University of Science and Technology near Beijing.
I usually spend 5 hours a day playing video games. There's nothing else to do here. Everyone in my dorm is like this. We spend 4 years at university wasting time, and after we graduate, we'll be facing unemployment.
After spending their childhood studying for test after test in China's brutally competitive public school system, Xie and his classmates are burned out.
They're just drifting by.
Jiang Shui-Qin has been involved in China's education system for more than a decade, first as a journalist, now as an educator. Jiang says Xie and his friends are what he calls typical college students in China. Chinese colleges typically have low expectations. Once students choose their major, they can't change it. Xie, for example, majored in information management because, he says, it sounded interesting. Jiang says none of this is good for Chinese companies looking for creative talent.
Chinese schools aren't producing this talent. In fact, maybe they're taking some very creative people and making them uncreative. And so this has tremendous economic implications.
Jiang says for Chinese businesses, it begins the day you hire a college grad.
You basically have to teach them from all over again. So you basically have to design your own education system because the Chinese system failed these kids. The costs, the human costs, are just tremendous.
Of course, China's a big place. Not all college grads are slouching video game addicts. But for those who aren't, China's job market isn't inspiring. A quarter of last year's 6 million college grads have yet to find jobs. In Hubei province, I'm Rob Schmidt for Marketplace.
And we have more about China's education system on Rob's Chinopoly blog at marketplace.org. Kai is in China, too, and he's blogging about the trip. Find that on our website as well.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the Knowledge Effect. By FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at Putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, football fans in a beer-soaked city did it, so why not beer drinkers on the internet? The Green Bay Packers are owned by their fans, and perhaps with that in mind, some enterprising fans of Pabst Brewing Company recently took to Facebook and Twitter to round up money to buy the beer maker. They got 5 million people to promise $200 million for the venture. All well and good, except before they could raise a glass to their efforts, the federal government said, hold the suds. Registering with the Securities and Exchange Commission is a must-do before selling shares to the public. They will have to drown their sorrows elsewhere. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 21 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ took off 26 points, almost 1%. And the S&P 500 ticked down 5 points. That's 0.4%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, there's plenty of blame to go around in the foreclosure mess.
The biggest problem we have are not with Bank of America mortgages or Chase or Wells or Citi. It's with government-owned mortgages.
And that's why thousands of people are turning up for mortgage modification help in convention centers across the country. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.